As Susan mentioned, I started what's called Raja Yoga practice at age 22 or 3, and it's a meditative form of yoga where there was certainly asanas, but the emphasis was on meditation. And then in my mid-30s, somewhere in the mid-30s, I discovered Vipassana meditation, Theravadan Buddhism, and switched my emphasis. And so that's been many, many, many years. And one of the things that has puzzled me in the last 20 plus years that I've been teaching Vipassana is why our community doesn't live up to the degree of mindfulness that it has. So our community has a huge amount of mindfulness, and because we've all been very good yogis, we've come and listened and applied what we've learned, and it's affected our lives in many positive ways. All of us. I'm making a general out there, but certainly for most of us, I think there would be a positiveness. If there wasn't, you wouldn't be here tonight. And yet, given the potential of the capacity we've developed, how much actually manifests? And my observation, and I spend my life doing this and helping people in changes and transitions, this is really all I do. And so I have lots of data points. And I feel this gap. This gap. So it's not that that we need more capability in one sense. It's that we need to utilize the capability that we have, or we need the capability to live out our capability, if that were a better way of saying it to you. And a few years ago at Marin Sangha, I gave this talk called The Gap. And I'm doing a very different teaching tonight around it, but it was inspired by this wonderful line from a New Yorker article that was written by Andre Ackerman, in which he starts out, he's talking about his mother, and the title of the article is "Are You Listening?" and "Conversations with My Deaf Mother." And he says, "I always knew my mother couldn't hear, but I remember when it dawned on me that she would always be deaf. If I was told, I didn't believe it." He had not really accepted. There was a gap between what was an obvious truth and his knowing the truth. Or said another way, his knowing that he knows. And so it is in our life in relation to wisdom. We know so many times that something we're getting ready to say or do, or we're in the midst of saying and doing, is not really what we would choose. This is not a good idea. We already know this. And yet, open that refrigerator door again, call up our frenemy and say, "You want to go to lunch?" And then we're going to have this miserable lunch with our frenemy who can do nothing but actually compete with us and put us down. Or whatever it may be, you volunteer at work again when you're not recognized for that volunteering at all, and they sort of manipulate the situation now so that you will volunteer. And yet off you go to volunteer. And in a relation to ourselves, the way we talk to ourselves about ourselves, the way we start to judge ourselves or compare ourselves or tell these stories about ourselves, which we know are just stories, and yet off we go. So what constitutes that gap, and what can we do about it? And that's what we're going to explore a bit tonight. And then this weekend, we're going to take part of what we are we're going to go into a lot of different subtle aspects that we don't have time to do tonight, that will all be in the context of the Four Noble Truths. And so tonight we're mostly being in the context, as you will see, of our mindfulness practice. So this gap, you could say that it is the period of time between the stimulant, a thought, a body sensation, a sound, a taste, a smell, coming into our field of consciousness, and then how we choose to relate to that. If we touch a hot stove, our relationship is instant and wise. Maybe we weren't so wise by not paying attention in the first place, but we're just right away, it's an instant recognition. Sometimes that recognition that, oh, there's some dukkha here, there's some unease, unsatisfactoriness in this, takes us a while to recognize. Other times, we know it's unsatisfactory, it's not going anywhere, we're going to end up feeling bad about ourselves, our stomach's going to hurt, or our we're going to feel diminished by the way we were treated by this person we're still choosing to interact with. And so we know it, but we don't know it. You know, we know it, but we didn't know it somehow. That's, we didn't know that we know it, and therefore we didn't have choice. So that's tonight we're going to look at this, a kind of three-part recognition system to see if, like, for each of us individually, well, if I broke this down to smaller pieces of perception, would that actually engender developing new habits around my mindfulness, to make my mindfulness be more dynamic? So that's the exploration. You'll just see if this, do you recognize and relate to part of this, or all of it, or none of it, and just see. It's an exploration, it's open. So there's not something to like really learn here, and this is it's a more open inquiry in that way. And I'm going to suggest that there's three gaps in terms of our either being wisely relating or not wisely relating in this particular framework. The first one is the one I've been talking about, the gap between the experience and our recognition that what's going on. So we have the experience, but we aren't registering it, just not registering at all. And then the second gap is between when we do recognize the experience and we are really able to know it. And then the third is this knowing and choosing, that we really are able to choose. We recognize, I'll go over this in great detail in a minute, but we recognize, oh, this is really not wholesome. This isn't skillful. And we know, oh, I've got this practice. You know, I can choose otherwise. I don't have to do this. But then we don't act. We don't do that. We it's not that we didn't know. We do know, but that knowing does not lead to action. So you can be sitting there talking to yourself as you're eating something that you know you're allergic to or have a hard time digesting. You already know it, but you don't have a choice to say, you're not able to say no. Seeing some recognition out there, huh? And this is spread throughout our lives in small ways and medium-sized ways and large ways. And this gap in this way. Sometimes it seems normal, like when we don't notice it much, and other times it feels like this looming chasm in our life where we're helpless. We don't feel in control of our own lives, and that can be very unsettling. So there's a way I am breaking it down for our purposes of inquiry, that in terms of with our mindfulness, being present in the moment so that we're mindful, we recognize the first thing that we do, that we want to make sure we do, is that we fill that first gap so that we recognize we're being mindful. So we recognize, oh, this is not skillful. This isn't onward leading in practice or in our daily lives. I keep bringing this back to daily life because that's where our biggest opportunity for practice is daily life, because that's where we spend almost all of our time. So that we say, okay, I want to develop this habit of recognizing what is suffering and non-suffering. What is suffering and non-suffering? Being very upset about the politics can be a spontaneous thing, but then feeding that cannot be skillful, because we've been upset so many times, and being upset in this moment isn't when we can work the phones or do anything, but we go on in a way that we're actually building in a feeling of helplessness. We're not empowering ourselves. So to recognize, so that we learn more and more, we're using our mindfulness to know what is suffering or not suffering, what is skillful and not skillful, what is wholesome and unwholesome. These different ways of describing this that's in the Dhamma, but we have this clear intent that in the moment to moment, as I made reference to in the meditation, in this very moment, my intention is to recognize what brings satisfaction and what doesn't bring satisfaction, what is meaningful, what's not meaningful, all of these different ways of describing it, but that the mindfulness is actually being applied so that we do recognize. So we are having that first knowing, that we're using our Dhamma eyes to know, oh yeah, it seemed like a good idea, but it's not now. Or I can feel this, but I'm feeling the impulse to do this, but I know better. That recognition. So we more quickly start to recognize, so that our mindfulness informs us. Clear enough? Okay. And that I call recognizing suffering and non-suffering. The second is to realize we have choice. So first we recognize, little fork in the road here. And the second is, so that's the recognize. And then the second is that we realize we have choice. And this, I've talked to so many different students about this through the years. And it's only afterwards that they remember they had choice. They don't remember in the moment they had a choice. Is anyone in the room the exception to that? I'm certainly not. It's amazing. But we actually, we don't realize we have a choice. The momentum is strong of habit, or the attraction of the stimulant, or the aversion to the stimulant that's arising in the moment, or our conditioning is so deeply embedded that we don't even have that moment of going, oh no, I have a choice here. So that's the second. So we recognize, the first thing to do is that we recognize, oh no, this isn't wholesome, this isn't skillful, this is dukkha, however you would phrase that. But it's a recognition of suffering. And then the second is you realize we have choice. Oh, I have a choice here. And it's far better to do it afterwards than not do it at all. But it's far better doing it in the middle than doing it afterwards. And it's far better doing it close to the beginning than in the middle. And it's far better doing it just before it's going to start than towards the beginning. And it's far better still to do it, you know, when you've got some space around it before, you know, you're going to have to sort of back yourself out somehow. And practice moves that spectrum. We recognize suffering sooner and sooner by practice. And likewise, we realize we have choice sooner and sooner. Well, I have choice here. There's many a time I didn't open this refrigerator door. I don't have to open it this time. Oh, look at my mind justifying doing it. Oh, I'm getting into this argument with this person at work. It never goes anywhere. Or I'm getting into this whole thing with my sister. Why am I doing this? Yeah, and we realize, oh, we do have choice. So we know what's dukkha and what's not dukkha. We realize we have a choice. And here is the third gap, is that we then don't act on our choice. We don't act on our choice. We don't act on our choice. So it's not like hearing this, oh, wow, that's a good point. I got that now. From now on, I won't be that way. We're actually looking at something here that is really a concerted effort over time, usually around a few things at once. We're replacing unskillful habits with skillful habits of mind, with unwholesome tendencies of mind with wholesome tendencies of mind. So we recognize, we realize, and then we resolve and act. So first we got to recognize, we can't, that gap where we don't recognize the lack of skillfulness here. So we recognize, oh no, this is suffering. And then we realize that we have a choice. Even if we're in the middle of it, even if we're at the end of it, we still have a choice as to what, as to how we're relating to it. We always have some degree of choice about how we're relating to it, no matter how we're caught up in it. Because sometimes it's only that we realize that being totally caught up in this, totally in the hell realm of this, feels like this. Even that is space. We're not totally identified. We're not totally grasping. We're creating some space that will help us for future choices, and in this moment, start to give us some degree of choice in this moment, just that way. So we recognize the gap. We realize we have choice, and we resolve to enact. There's this through. So we're breaking down what's something that can, when we're in our area of wisdom, we do all that in a minute, right? We all have very good moments, a lot of good moments when we act skillfully, we're wholesomely motivated, we recognize it, and on. We all have this. But then we have the moments we don't. And so we're addressing the moments we don't as a learning, not as a judging, not as a comparing. Learning. Learning requires discerning, and then it requires practice. And repetition is a big part of practice. And then we need rewards. And the rewards is that we realize, oh, wow, I didn't do that this time. Whew. And I consciously didn't do it. I remember that. I can't remember his name or anything. Or exactly. I'm not even sure where I was. But this guy was talking about this thing of having choice. And I realized I had choice, and I actually took choice. Hey, that works. You know, that's all that needs to come out of this. And so then looking at each of these individually, we are so pulled into our experience oftentimes that we don't have a habit of being mindful. That the mindfulness we have leaves us because it's such a strong stimulant of aversion or lust, wanting, or it's so triggering a younger version of ourself, or just it's somehow been conditioned in. So knowing that we have to practice this, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with us. It means that that our potential that is here has not been developed. And that requires getting more and more clear about how we wish to live moment to moment. So I refer to this as having an intentional life. And I said in the meditation deliberately, which that there's a big difference between our aspiration, our goals, and this very moment. And our values are in this very moment manifesting or not. This is the second of the Eightfold Path, wise intention, Sammasankappa. So this ability to have an intention, I intend to be present in a way that I recognize what's suffering and not suffering. I want this to be a core of the way I meet the moments of my life. I want to know what's suffering and non-suffering as coming from outside or coming from inside. I want to know that difference. And that's intention to know, this intention to recognize, because we see how beneficial it is, not just for ourselves, but for all those we come in contact with. So as we learn to see more clearly, we're going to benefit others too. And I stress that because so many times when we're down on ourselves, we kind of give up on ourselves. But if we're doing this for others too, even if it only makes a little bit of difference for others, we can't imagine it making much difference, but it might make some difference for others, and that's the motivation to stay present, to really apply mindfulness. We need that motivation because our own ego falls into its own abysses and so forth, as we all know in this room. A second thing is if we're going to recognize that suffering, we're going to be able to differentiate what's suffering and non-suffering, is a huge amount of compassion. So we're interested in knowing, but we have compassion for the fact that it's human nature that we choose suffering over non-suffering. So we have compassion. It's an understanding heart. Without that, we're so oftentimes not going to recognize in time to have choice. We just won't. It's better to go ahead and do this thing of excessive eating, drinking, yelling at someone, judging someone, whatever it is that. Because we can't stand to know ourselves. We imagine that ourselves so terrible without being conscious of it that we don't stay present. We abandon ourselves. We get caught up in this emotional moment and we abandon ourselves. But we can build in, and I've seen this with a number of people, it's not just a few people, we can build in a habitual recognition of compassion towards the human situation. And we're part of the human situation. We live in this realm. All of us share this realm. We share unity in this realm in this way. And this knowing capacity of the mind, the knowing is seeing it as human and the nature of this realm rather than, oh, John, Jose, April, Sky, it's not our individualness that we're seeing so much. This is the way human beings are. Oh, and there's this movement towards suffering. Okay, no need to judge. And then this is true. And do I have choice? So this question of realizing you have choice, you realize, oh, I have choice. Or you realize, I might have choice here. For myself, I have totally known I have choice and turned out not to have choice. Like I thought I'm going to divert here and I don't divert. I just don't. And so this realization this way. And again, in terms of being able to recognize dukkha, which the Buddha teaches over and over again, as though it's going to be easy in a sense, if we have been told it, but it's not so much that way, is this difference between discernment and judgment. If we collapse into a judging mind or comparing mind, we're gonna get frozen right there, and it's not onward leading. So the mindfulness that's onward leading is the mindfulness that allows us to recognize we have choice. this kind of, so what we're doing at this level of recognizing suffering and non-suffering, we're recognizing the object as it is. We're being mindful of the characteristic of the object. So being angry, okay, so anger is present, and anger has these characteristics. We're recognizing the arising object, which is what mindfulness does, as opposed to just a moment of consciousness. We can be, oh, I'm angry, but that's not really being very mindful of it. Mindfulness is being, we're mindfulness of anger in its surround. It feels like this. It has this effect. There's a full recognition. The Venerable Samedo talks about it as that you're aware of what's arising. You feel it fully, so that it really registers in you, like the anger would really register in you. And so that then therefore you can recognize it, and then you can investigate it, and you treat it in an impersonal manner. A human being is having this experience. So the fully receiving something to be, and really, if we just glance at it, and so often, that's why we don't recognize that we're doing something that's going to cause us suffering. We glance at it and move away. So this really using the mindfulness to fully know an object in you. Every time you're on an evening class or a day long or a retreat, the practice of doing that is over and over, and you hear endless Dharma talks about that. So, and then the second part of this is the realization that we do have a choice. And this is being mindful of our intention, that we intend to have choice. We intend to be able to choose non-suffering over suffering in little ways. So like being on the highway and getting mad at the other drivers because they're traffic. So our intention is to be able to have choice. You know, I'm on this highway too. I'm everyone else's traffic. You know, so we have a clear intention to have choice as to not going on with unwholesome mind states, unwholesome actions, unskillful actions. We have a clear intention, and we realize we have a choice here. And so we realize, okay, I don't know how much choice I have, but I'm going to do whatever amount of choice I have in this moment. And this involves a kind of heart quality. The more we have seen ourselves get caught in our judging mind or our unskillful acts, if we really stay present, if that recognition is there, you know, the heart at some point just doesn't want it anymore, at least this particular one. The heart just doesn't want it anymore. It just kind of drops away on its own if we keep doing the first one of that we recognize suffering. It just drops away, and we realize that at some point that just tired of it is where the choice emerges from. And we realize, oh, there is choice here. We just don't want to do it anymore. And how does that mean? That means that we don't speak, or we change how we're speaking, or we leave the room if it's the suffering we're creating by speaking, or if it's action, we interrupt our action, or we take a different action, or we don't do anything. Or we recognize we're confused and we don't really know what's the right thing to do here, so we do nothing when we're confused. We don't act out of our confusion despite there being strong passion to act. We don't act out of our confusion because we know that the predominant experience is confusion, and confusion is not a place to act from. Now, sometimes we have to get more, there needs to be clarity, so we act to get clarity, but that's not the same thing as picking up the phone and calling this person and yelling at them. I really want to understand what really happened at work on Friday when I wasn't there. Then I'll choose what's the right action. I will not let myself, I feel this heat, but I will not act out of this heat. I will not act out of this heat. I have a choice not to do that. Yes, they've done this to me 6 other times, and maybe this is the 7th time or the 25th time, but I don't know. I will know before I act. I have a choice. I have a choice here. Even though my mind's filled with, I do have a choice. And so therefore we know that we have a choice. And then the third part is that another part about this. So when we recognize that there's a choice, this is an uncomfortable moment, this talk. When we recognize we have a choice, if you really get real with yourself, you are now accountable. We are accountable for what we know. I don't like that so much sometimes. But we're accountable for what we know. And it is amazing how clever we are at not knowing that. And you could say that why you don't, one of the reasons that you actually don't act out your level of capability is because you don't want to have this, you don't want to have this accountability. So we think that we don't do things because we think we're going to fail or we can't do it and all this. But maybe, in fact, what's more scary to us is owning our capability. Or if that's too much for you, at least as scary to us, is to really say, oh no, I know I am capable. I know I have choice. Because then we are accountable for it. And not in a judging way, oh, you're really bad, shame, shame on you, or guilt, guilt, guilt. It's not like that. It's like this, the heart's choice, this courage coming from the heart, this courage to be. And it's a very wonderful thing when we discover a new area of our life where we're willing to be accountable. We may have been a very responsible person in 6 ways in our life, but then there's this one way which we've actually not been so accountable. In my change and transition work, one of the great pleasures I have is helping people make a transition in things like that, where they become accountable for something they haven't been accountable for in their life. A certain aspect of the relationship with their significant other or with their children or with the way they behave towards themselves or towards the environment or whatever it might be. So we recognize that what we're doing, what we're going to say or what we are saying, what we are doing or going to do is suffering. We realize our mindfulness tells us that. Then our mindfulness remembers, because smriti, this Sanskrit word smriti, mindfulness has at various times in its history been taught as remembering. And there is a remembering aspect, remembering what? Our intention. So the mindfulness and intention are like joined together. Because mindful of what? Intention. But then what is our intention? We got to be mindful of our intention. So they go together like this. And then we actually come to making the choice. And one way to do this is to think that I want to walk my talk. I really want to walk my talk. And to notice how good it feels when you live up to what you know, when you live up to your value. At first, the amount of time that it feels good is small compared to the not getting to do what you want to do, whether it's eat, or scream, or whatever it is, feel sorry for yourself, whatever it is. It's first, it's a very small reward compared to the frustration. But in time, it becomes much more balanced. And then in time, the other way. And we call that, we can call it integrity in our lives, or we can call it continuity, where there's a continuity of our being authentic to ourselves. And that continuity of authenticity is more rewarding than the stimulant, responding to the stimulant of the moment. I can say this firsthand, and I'm nowhere near a perfect example or even a great example, but it is really true that staying authentic, having continuity, is worth more than the immediate the rewards. Because of Nietzsche, because things always change, we get the reward from abusing ourselves with food or alcohol or whatever you do with our sexuality or our misusing our authority that we have over someone, our power in some way. There can be an immediate reward, but that reward always goes away. It always goes away. This is the truth of Nietzsche. It's one of the three characteristics of this realm. That's why the Buddha stressed it so much. So therefore, if we've seen that clearly and we remember that, and when we don't remember it, we then remind ourselves afterwards, we get much more interested in this continuity of well-being rather than episodic moments of temporary satisfaction. It's not that, as a long-term strategy, it's not that great a strategy, these temporary moments of satisfaction. Although we do need them, we really need them. It's just how much emphasis we give them. So we're not talking about becoming ascetics necessarily, but we are saying that we have more choice and we're willing to make those choices. We will do renunciation, and renunciation is one of the Buddha's key teachings, is around renunciation. And why? Because if we're not capable of renouncing our desire of this moment, we can't make wise choice. We're always drawn by our passions. We're drawn by our habits. We're drawn by the stimulant, somebody else wanting us to do. So we have to be able to renounce the immediate gratification. It's very practical. It's not some theoretical thing or some mystical thing. We have to be able to renounce. And so we have to develop our renunciation muscle to be able to do that, so that we can choose non-suffering, that we can recognize it, that we can see that we've got a choice, and then we can make this choice. We can be resolute in making that choice. And so that's the range here of this. And it's very confusing because of our habits of mind. We got so many habits of mind that are, it's just the way we're put together. Read you something here for a moment, and then I will take some questions. Where is my... Oh, here it is. This is from T.S. Eliot, and he wrote it in 1934. You will be amazed at how current. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? In our information age? So we have lost knowledge. I'm going to say it proactively. We have lost knowledge in all of our information. And in our knowledge, we have lost wisdom. Where is the life we have lost in living? This is why we would choose to be able to recognize suffering. This is why we would choose to recognize that we have choice. Therefore, we'd realize that we have choice. This is why we would then be resolute in making that choice, living it out, so that we gain the life that we have lost. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? To reclaim this deeper sense of self, this continuity of self, this feeling authentic to ourselves, feeling coherent to ourselves, the Dhamma can do this for us, but we have to live it. We have to make a life of it, and not just be living all of our reactions to the various stimulants of objects of mind that arise from the sense gates. So, with that, take questions or comments. And there's two people will be coming around with microphones. So there's a lady right here, please. If you'll hold your hand up again.
What is that T.S. Eliot quote from?
That's from it's called The Rock, a pageant play. Any gaps in your life that you notice that anybody wants to talk about?
I have a question which probably includes what you just asked about. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about accountability. You said we might avoid things because we're afraid or guilty, or we think that that's why, but actually maybe it's a fear of being accountable. Can you talk a little bit more about what accountability is to you?
Okay. To talk more about accountability. So I think on my Dharma Wisdom website, there is a whole 40-minute talk on sitting in the fire of accountability. And if it's not there, it might be on Dharma Seed, but I think it's on Dharma Wisdom, my own website. Taking you as an example, you know, there's things where you don't act within the range of what you have as capability. You've gotten burned by that in the past. You've had defeat, or you've had whatever, or like if you really say, okay, I know this is the way it is, you will then make other decisions. But if you don't ever really have to say, I know this is how it is, we keep looking for love in the wrong places. We keep looking for nourishment in the wrong places. All of those kinds of things, and the accountability is to saying, you know, at least in this area, in this amount of this, on every Monday, I'm going to be accountable. That we start to take some modest degree of accountability. We're saying, I'm in relation to at least this specific thing. I will not. I don't have an excuse anymore. I have no excuses left. There are causes and conditions, but I don't have any excuse. I can relate to this in the moment as it's happening. So I may not be able to stop it from happening, but I can stay in relation. I can stay mindfully present the whole way through the disaster, the catastrophe, and not be identified and lost in it. Even though I'm having the catastrophe happen, I am present for it. That's the accountability. And through that, you're seeing, is there any point that I can interrupt this? And sometimes there's not. Sometimes we just go right on. That interrupting, that having the choice, that acting on the choice is right effort in the Eightfold Path. So diverting the mind when it's an unwholesome, if it's wholesome, staying with all of that. That again, that's what we're doing this evening. So that's the accountability. And again, at first, sitting in the fire of accountability is mostly uncomfortable, but you kind of go, well, at least I'm doing it. But at some point, it becomes actually just fine. we develop a kind of equanimity around it, and we feel real to ourselves. Because so often, you know, we don't feel real to ourselves. We don't feel authentic. We don't feel a continuity of this moment to this moment. There's not a, it does feel like these moments are just coming and going. And as we recognize that there is this kind of continuity, this feeling of authentic to ourselves, that helps us be accountable, but also we go, I want to be accountable for this. There is a reward in this. There's a sense of beingness, of well-beingness, that is worthy of this. So that's a start. Another one?
Thank you so much. Since you're talking about choice, can you talk some from your experience where issues of the different privileges that we might bring to any problem we're having, whether of race or age, where you might have suggestions or just experiences of where choice is not equally available to all of us?
Talking about choice in relation to privilege is complicated because that's choice around things we want, and I'm talking about choice around things that are unskillful. So, but an easy example is around the people of affluence can create a lot of climate damage because of their affluence. They can afford to do the things that cause the climate damage. You just don't know what I mean about that. Again, that wasn't the topic this evening, but that would be an example where sitting in the fire of accountability, that I along with the other, you know, 20 million of me are acting in a way that's causing this problem, and I choose not to do that. I'm causing dukkha to this world and all the people in this world, so I choose not to do that anymore because it's dukkha. That's again, I wasn't looking at the grand scale of this. I was talking about individual choice, but then you generalize out in terms of yourself as a citizen of the planet, a member of this global village. And then in terms of versus some, that's for all people. Again, in terms of an individual, that you don't take a turn just because you can have the turn. Because that, and you're taking your turn, someone who doesn't have that turn, if you don't take your turn, someone else gets it. And you mindfully choose, I'm not going to take this turn at whatever, get this goodie, I'm going to let this goodie go to someone else. And that would be a way of using choice, and that this is kind of the bridge over in that way. So that could mean, all sorts of things. So,
do you think that choice is available equally to all of us, regardless of what we bring?
No. The people. I see what you're. Oh, that's a whole other matter. Oh no, well, there's this kind of choice I'm talking about tonight. That without the Dhamma eyes, you, it's very hard to do. That you need some, I think it's my opinion, in my view, this is a view and opinion, that without some framework for looking at our behavior, it's very difficult to not just be motivated by what we want. And that we think that's this world's suffering anyway, and we're just going to get what we want, or that, you know, that all the different things. So I'm going to get rewarded later, and I'm, we excuse ourselves that way, rewarded, you know, in some other way, in an afterlife or something. So some framework, it doesn't have to be Buddhism, but there has to be some framework where you can actually be genuine with yourself and have a technique. Mindfulness is just a technique. Vipassana and mindfulness are not the same thing. Mindfulness is a tool within the whole insight practice, and it is part of the Eightfold Path, but only one part of the Eightfold Path. So it's like that. One last one.
So with respect to accountability, my understanding is that you're talking about accountability to our principles and our values according mm-hmm. to the Eightfold Path and,
yes.
and the values that are set out there.
Yes.
And so that's a different issue than the kind of sort of temporal choices that we have.
Yes. Yes. So we're accountable for what we know. And we know, and right, it's the Eightfold Path is about suffering and non-suffering. I'll just close with this for a second. You know, mindfulness is the flavor of the decade or something, and everybody offers mindfulness in everything. But and I've written about this. You can find this on various places too. But the Buddha's mindfulness is the mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. Mindfulness can actually get you advantage. You would learn mindfulness if you want to have advantage. The person that's most mindful in the room is the one that's going to see the most opportunities. But that's not the Buddha's mindfulness. The Buddha's mindfulness is about being able to recognize what is suffering and not suffering, and have the ability and the values that would have you choose non-suffering. Yeah, mindfulness is in the Majjhima, twice the Buddha refers to wrong mindfulness. Now, the Abhidhamma, this kind of encyclopedia rule book, says that when mindfulness is present, it's always wholesome. But that's some monks later making that decision. That was not. And so the Venerable Sumedho would say that the thief coming through your breaking into your house and stealing your computer off your kitchen table while you're asleep in the bedroom is very mindful. But that's not a wholesome mindfulness. And when you read the accounts of why people steal, they do, in those kinds of situations, they're getting a high out of it. It is a high to be able to do that because you're so mindful. You're so totally present. It's a high. And a rock climber, which is doing something that is ethically neutral, and being a rock climber, they're having to be so mindful. And they talk, that wonderful movie that was out last year, talks the high of being able to do that. That's mindfulness. They're being very mindful. They're really present in the moment. But that's not what the Buddha is meaning by mindfulness. But you do get a high doing the Buddha's mindfulness also. but there is intention, and it's from a view. It's a view. It is right view. We always have a view. Every person in this room is living their life towards a view, acknowledged or unacknowledged. You have a view of what makes life valuable and have what there's a whole. We all have a view. The Buddha in this, he starts with that thing. The very first of the Eightfold Path is wise view. Like, what will really bring the most well-being to life? What will bring this well-being? And he presents a view, and he's presenting it intellectually and then saying, live it out. So, you know, here's what I think it is. But first of all, just understand what is view. And then, so this is what I think it is. Live it out and see for yourself. Eipasiko, come see for yourself. Don't believe me. Just see. So we're all doing this. And again, this fire of accountability would go, yeah, this is really true. I'm now 28 or 48 or 68 or 88. Hey, I really want to kind of take this into consideration for a while and live like this. That's what I found so attractive about this practice, because it was not, in my Raja Yoga practice, I had so many bliss states arise. I mean, and when I first went to a Vipassana retreat and they said, don't control the breath. And I thought, don't they know that's how you get bliss states? But what was so powerful about Buddhism is it's not the escapism of getting into an exalted state that the Buddha is pointing to. He's fine with going into those absorptions and all, but he's saying it's in the It's being in the recognition of our lives that we find real freedom in the end. We get temporary freedom when we get in our meditative state and we're all protected from the hindrances. But it's when we can see the hindrances and not succumb to them, that's the real freedom. That's the real freedom. And I buy that. I buy that. I make claim to my bliss states because here's someone who had that alternative without drugs and said, no, I buy this. This makes more sense to me in terms of the meaning of a life, having a meaningful life. And that's what brought me to the Dhamma. So usually it'll come in through suffering. There's suffering gate. There's the anicca gate, that everything's always changing. And then there's the what's called the not self gate, which is, so what is the meaning of all this? What's the there in this life? And that's what brought me to the Dhamma, is I wanted more clarity about what's the there here. You know, like, so we each find our own way. And I'm speaking in a kind of non, like, little sweet Dharma talk way here about laying out life, you know. I'm at an age now that's what I'm interested in, is okay, what is this, the nature of all of this? Tomorrow I'm going to talk about Sumedho. I was just with Venerable Sumedho, and he's like 13 years older than me, and he's gone another whole step. I'm in my 70s, he's in his 80s, and Wow, has he really gone that way? So, thank you for your time. And oh, I'm sorry, the announcements, Suze. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Thank you so much, Philip. You can see why we love having Philip back here.